Welcome everyone to another episode of All Things Trek. Unfortunately, this is our second non-live show in a row because we had schedule issues and we couldn't do a live show, so we are pre-recording one. And Bob wouldn't join me this week either. It is, I know, multiple sadness. Instead, I am joined by my brother Ari.
Hello, everyone.
And my dearest Lillian.
Hi.
And today we have our topic, which is a look back at the 2009 J.J. Abrams Star Trek movie, because I realized that I've been talking about it a lot recently, what with the upcoming, 2013 movie. I say upcoming, but it's not coming out until May. But, I've been talking about the 2009 movie a lot, and I haven't seen it pretty much since it came out. I saw it twice when it came out, and I haven't seen it since then. So we rented it, we watched it again, and it's time we want to give our thoughts. But first, I actually have an email to read and comment on. And we're recording this on Tuesday, so if you send your email after that and you're listening to this, I will answer them next week, I promise. So, all right. This is from a new emailer. I don't think we've ever gotten an email from this lady before, from someone named Gabby D. And the email is, "Hi guys, so I'm a new listener and I had a few comments on your recent shows. Episode 54, Religiosity in Trek, Part 1. While McCoy did refer to the creation of Earth in 6 days as a myth, there was in fact a mention of the one god in Who Mourns for Adonis, where Kirk says, 'Mankind has no need of gods, we find the one quite adequate.' As to no organized religion was shown, yes there was, but it was non-human or non-federation, and it was often machines that were worshipped as gods, machines that Kirk ended up destroying time and again, even when some of the machines were benevolent, or at least caused no real willful harm. If anything, besides the Bajorans and the Voyager Chakotay episodes, all gods in Trek were attempted to be brought down to a human level and dealt with as such. Heck, even the Klingons slew their gods, as they were more trouble than they were worth, according to Worf. Another stab at Kirk was shown in the episode The Naked Time, where the turbolift doors close, and Kirk is faced with graffiti on the turbolift door that reads, 'Sinner, repent.' And who is the greatest sinner of Trek if not Kirk? And yes, I am talking about the 60s sex outside of marriage mentality." And then she provides a link for a video where it shows that clip. And I do remember that clip. And one thing that's interesting about the line where Kirk says, "We find the one quite adequate," if you listen to the way he says it with a little bit of derision?
Derision.
Derision. Yeah, that's the word I'm looking for, derision. Just a little. It's kind of subtle, but it's there. And I've always taken that to mean, and this is, and I'm not being anti-religion here, but I have taken this to mean that in Kirk's view, we have enough problems with our own religions, and we don't need more. That was sort of my interpretation of the way he said that line. Now, if you want an episode that says that they are religious, that's the one you're looking for is the episode where they find the alternate Rome. Because at the end of that, they find out that Jesus Christ is coming to fake Rome, and he's going to fix everything. And Uhura gets all misty-eyed over it. And that's like Uhura's only contribution to the episode, is talking about how these Romans are worshipping Jesus Christ, and it's going to be awesome. So there is that. And I do believe we did talk about organized religion among the non-humans. Maybe we didn't. Maybe I missed that part. You guys have anything you want to comment on that before we move on to the second part?
That's not what I've been researching today.
Yeah, you've just mentioned a bunch of TOS, and that's just not really my forte. I know a little bit about the Bajoran religion from my DS9 watching, but...
Go watch more TOS, Harry.
I can't put on 60s vision. It just doesn't work for me.
Enjoy it.
It's too campy.
Love the camp.
I can't do it.
All right. And then her second point is re-episode 61, which is Wuv Twoo Wuv. Because, I love Princess Bride. In this episode, I found it queer that you've ignored several aspects of romance in TOS. The temporary willingness of major characters to give it all up for love, such as Spock in All Our Yesterdays, he would have stayed with Zarabeth, if not for McCoy. I'd forgotten that lady even had a name. I just remember her as, like, Cave Lady. And Kirk in The City on the Edge of Forever. Some argue that Kirk would have saved Edith Keeler even if the whole Federation would have been wiped out. The road not taken by Kirk. His reaction to meeting his ex in The Wrath of Khan, that's Dr. Marcus. His reaction to how his son was raised by his ex, and what his son thinks of his career in Starfleet. and there's a lot that comes from an initial unshown romance. Another road not taken was Kirk's desire to marry Antonia, whoever the heck she was, that was my little aside, in Star Trek VII in the Nexus. He had genuine desire to make it, his life, different. And lastly, I was a bit perplexed by the choice, by Oren, I think, to name Worf and Jadzia's romance the best one in Deep Space Nine. The one in the following link, for me at least, is far longer in the making and far more emotional, with far more subtext, even when most of the emotions are one-sided and run under the surface. And then she provides a YouTube link to a kind of neat little music video about Odo and Kira. And I did talk about the Odo and Kira relationship. I did mention it. And, you know, obviously this is all a matter of opinion, but personally, I think the Dax-Worf relationship works a little bit better, because it feels a little more natural, and I was, like, the Kira-Odo one, they drag it on a little too long. Just a little bit too long. By the time it finally, you know, concludes and I get the payoff, I was kind of bordering on not caring anymore.
I think this might also have to do with the fact that you have a boy crush on Jadzia Dax, so for you, it's much more invested when she gets married.
Yes.
Where... perhaps for Odo and Kira, you're not as, you know, into it.
Yeah, I mean, that's probably true. I am much... although Kira is one of my favorite characters, and so is Odo, but I am definitely more attracted to Dax. And I don't know, I think they're, like... one of the things about the Kira-Odo relationship that always, like, underwhelmed me was that Odo is so amazingly non-humanoid, and yet their romance is so normal. Like, their romance is so almost stereotypical of boy, like, you know, like, not lusting. What's the other word I'm thinking of? It's late. I'm tired. But, like, lusting.
Longing?
Yeah, longing. That's the word I'm looking for. Longing for girl, and then eventually girl comes to her senses. Whereas I feel the Dax-Worf relationship, they actually used their alien backgrounds to make it work and made it more interesting on that level. And again, all opinion. I definitely don't dislike the Odo Kira relationship. The only romances in DS9 I dislike are O'Brien and Keiko and Julian and Ezri, which struck me as incredibly last minute. We need to pair Julian off with somebody.
I'm personally a fan of the little trumpeted Quark Odo love story. That's my favorite.
Well, I mean, if we're gonna do that, obviously Bashir and O'Brien.
That's fair. Epic romance
is obviously the best romance on the show, but it's only a romance because we can see the writers winking at us from behind the script.
Like, I say that I'm more emotional about that. I'm probably more emotional about Kira and Odo than I am about Jadzia Dax, even though, like, I do really like the relationship. Admittedly. There's a lot of times where the writers like to shoot Worf in the foot as a character, and at least with DS9, they didn't do it as much.
No, but still a little bit.
It's still there. I mean, you can't really ignore the fact that he's a man of honor with a child he didn't raise and, you know, kind of doesn't care or understand.
We don't like to talk about Alexander here.
No.
We don't want to talk about it. We've become convinced that Alexander is not actually Worf's kid and that he knows, but he's too honorable to say anything.
That still doesn't make you honorable.
No.
Like, his actions,
I mean,
like, that just even makes it worse.
It's terrible.
Need to man up and be a good dad in order to be an honorable man. I don't think that, you know...
You know who else has a terrible son? Martok. Martok's son is so lame that they erase him off... Yeah, you don't remember it, right? His son is in Way of the Warrior, and he is so lame that they erase him from canon. He never comes back. He's never even mentioned. Even though, like, they go through some really serious Martok episodes.
Pretty serious. What about your son? Now we don't talk about him.
Yeah, they never mention him again because he was so lame.
That's fair.
And obviously, at that point, I don't think they decided that they were going to make Martok a recurring character. I doubt they even knew Martok was a changeling at that point.
Have you actually had an episode where you looked over parenting?
No, I haven't.
That should be a good episode. Yeah. There's a lot of...
Yeah.
Does that mean we can review The Child?
Oh, yes. Child. I can only say rape is bad so many times.
But it was for science, Orin.
Apparently. And in that episode, and she's also, she's right, I did skip over a couple of one-episode romances in TOS, because I was specifically looking for long-running romances. I did specify that at the beginning of the episode, so, you know, I covered my ass there.
Did we go over Kirk and Spock?
Again, that's a romance only because we can see the writers winking at us.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not even sure that one was intentional. I think that just may be us reading into it.
I don't know. I mean, I feel like the way that Kirk is so jealous of Spock and will not let him have a girl. I mean, it's also just, you know, Kirk being like, no, no one can be content and happy, so that needs to stop whenever he sees Spock sort of going over to the fuzzy utopia side of the hypothetical utopian future. But it does seem like Kirk does not want to share Spock.
Oh, yeah. That's definitely a thing.
Looking back on it, all the relationships I'm really invested in emotionally are all, like, the bromances of Star Trek. Like, Geordi and Data and, you know, O'Brien and Bashir. I just can't bring myself to care as much about the others.
Well, I mean, let me lay it out on the table here. There is a difference between a really great friendship and a romance of two characters that are the same gender. For example, like Julian and Miles, their relationship is obviously a very good friendship, but there are a couple of points where it seems pretty clear that if the writers could have gotten away with having a homosexual couple on Star Trek, they would have done it. Especially with the point where they're in Sloane's mind, and Bashir's like, but I just like you more.
I really, really wish, actually, like, reflecting on it, that Bashir had been gay, because...
Yeah, me too.
Like, just the way he's introduced in the beginning of being so, like, I'm trying to have all the ladies, and I'm hitting on everybody. Like, it does seem like he's covering up, and we go into how, like, his entire personality is actually him hiding the fact that he's better than everyone else. And that would have been a really neat tie-in to be like, I'm better than everyone else, and I'm also gay.
Yep.
Deal with it.
Man, I wish that Star Trek had done that. I hope that maybe, fingers crossed, if we get another show, they'll do that. That would be really cool. But considering the fact that they got a huge amount of flack for having one lesbian kiss, and they were cheating even then by having it be like, well, she was a man.
She was a man once.
Although, granted, that almost makes it the first transgendered kiss, but whatever. They still got a lot of flack for that. I can imagine what would have happened if they'd had an actual, like, gay relationship on the show. People would have friggin' marched on them with crosses and torches.
I feel like we are maturing now, especially in the nerddom. Us in the nerddom, we actually, you know, we're getting sick and tired of the status quo being shoved down our throat as the right way. So maybe this next generation will be less homophobic. Maybe.
I hope so. I would really... But anyway... So thank you for the email, Gabby. I'm glad, and I also appreciate all these links. I can't play them on the podcast because it wouldn't quite work like that, but I do appreciate them. And I hope you will enjoy having your email read, and we'll send us in some more stuff. All right. So about this new Star Trek movie that everyone's been talking about.
Oh man, what are we? 2009 again.
It's we're gonna talk about this movie like it's 2009.
I'm gonna say that, like, off the bat, this movie was so good to me when I first saw it, just because it wasn't as bad as I thought it was going to be. I really thought that this was going to be, like, a painful experience, and they did really good job of, like, respecting the campiness, bringing that back, showing the characters, and making it fun.
Mm-hmm.
Watching it again, like, there are lots of things that I'm just like, I feel like you guys... We're trying to make it accessible, and in so doing, like, kind of were offensive to me. I mean, obviously, other people might not feel that way, but...
Well, give us some examples, because you were watching the commentary, and I caught, like, the second half of it when I got home.
Well, the big thing for me, or one of the big things for me, was that every single time that there's, like, a lady scene, I felt like they were really trying to target women. They were like, hey... There's stuff for you to be interested in here, too. And they admit in the commentary that that was what they were trying to do. They wanted to make a movie that they could bring their wives to, which kind of disturbs me that these guys who've grown up with Star Trek, grown up with Star Wars, this is their life. They are making the films. That their wives have to, like, be given a birth scene and, like, chatty ladies in order to actually get them to go to the theater. And... I don't know who this actually was, because I couldn't tell their voices apart well enough, but one of them said, and it totally worked, at the birth scene of Kirk, like, that's when my wife grabbed onto my hand and was teary-eyed and so happy, and I'm like, are they unaware of nerd girls? Are we just so rare that, like, we don't qualify as women?
I don't know. All right, so when I heard that, my the only thing I could think of was that either they're exaggerating for dramatic effect, because Star Trek is such a common thing, it's hardly even a nerd thing anymore.
And they were not mainstream. They were not playing this for laughs. They were straight up just saying that.
But I mean, there are just some people who don't like Star Trek. I mean, there's the thing.
Yeah, and
but
some of them marry people who are apparently, you know, beyond Trekkies.
Right, but I mean, like my mom, for example, I don't think I would qualify my mom as a nerd girl, but she's a huge Star Trek fan, obviously. She's the reason I like Star Trek.
Well, I'm just going to throw this back at you. Your mom is an intellectual, like, one of the top stars intellectuals of the world. She makes books and writes things and is a college professor. I think that qualifies you as a bit of a nerd, aside from being into Star Trek.
I suppose that's true.
Although I can't understand the thinking behind including a scene like that, because we're just going to keep using our mom as an example here. Our mom loves horses, and so a movie that will throw in a scene with a good horse scene will make her like the movie a lot more.
Although that's a double-edged sword.
If it's bad, it'll make her not like it.
Like
but
War Horse.
She's really forgiving of most horse things, and will like pretty much any horse you put on the screen. So
Except War Horse.
But that's a topic for another time. So I can understand the idea of pandering to that. I don't like the idea that that's all women, like, birthing is what women think about, so this is only for women. Because I found that scene really good when I was in the theater.
Yeah, I would hope that, you know, bringing life into the world wouldn't just be a one-sided, ladies are totally into this, and you guys are kind of like, why do babies have to happen?
What are babies? I don't even understand. I like that scene a lot. I think it was a totally different experience the second or whatever time we just recently watched this movie, sitting in the living room making fun of it. Mood is a big part of this movie, and the theater really brought that out in a way that watching it at home with friends didn't.
Well, yeah, I mean, so, there's like, that. One thing that I will say that...
Can I bring up my mom?
Yeah, go ahead, bring up your mom.
I just
I'll talk about our moms.
I just want to say that, like, it wasn't men that introduced me to Star Trek in the first place. My mom is, like... I'm not going to say hardcore Trekkie, because she's not the type of person that would put on a uniform and prance around, but she had a huge crush on Captain Kirk, and she showed me all of the original series and The Next Generation, and we watched some of DS9 together, and she was a single mom, so it wasn't even like she had a husband that was sitting on her to make her watch nerd things. This is completely, you know, from her side of the planet of us vaginas, I guess.
Mm-hmm. No, I mean, I definitely think that the fan base of Star Trek is probably one of the more evenly split ones when it comes to nerd things. I'd say it's also because it's just more accepting. I mean, I think one of the reasons why there aren't more women in a lot of nerd subcultures is because they tend to be, you know, kind of sexist and sort of exclusive.
There's less competitiveness in Star Trek, or at least... in the series. Like, I'm not going to say anything about the games because I haven't played them, but it's much less penis-waving contest than, even Star Wars. I mean, Star Wars guys are really into throwing numbers and at you. And
well, that lightsaber isn't a metaphor for, for female parts, if you know what I mean. Anyway, Ari, go ahead.
This scene always comes to my head when we're talking about how Star Trek's feeling towards women in TOS, Spock's line of, women are more deeply and easily frightened.
Yes, Spock did say that.
So, I do like Star Trek, and it does got a good message for tolerance, and eventually they gave the ladies some pants instead of skirt uniforms.
Hey, so, I liked it in the beginning when there was actually, I think it was
men's
like
skirt uniforms.
Yeah, men's skirt uniforms.
I thought that was cool.
That would be a much better compromise. You're allowed to wear skirts.
In the future where everyone can wear a skirt and not be ashamed. You know, it's great.
I was actually really happy to find out that a fellow podcaster of ours, a guy named Gettysburg Nick, he went to the Star Trek Las Vegas convention in that skirt uniform. Not ironically or anything. And he's like a super like macho ex-army guy. And I thought that was great. And people didn't give him shit for it. They were like, you know, everyone was like, yeah, you're wearing the skirt uniform.
Oh,
and it was awesome.
We haven't seen that since season one.
Yeah.
Awesome.
So I thought that was really cool.
It's one of those things where it's like, it would be nice to actually bring gender roles on an even keel instead of just saying women should be more like men and wear pants.
Yeah, true. No, that's true. But all right. So anyway, moving. That aside, I did actually think that the Kirk giving birth sequence did work pretty well. Kirk being born.
That's quite a feat.
Yeah, Kirk being born sequence. I thought that did work pretty well.
I will say one thing kind of bugs me every time I watch that.
Yeah?
They didn't know what gender it was and had not discussed names until that exact moment. And I guess
they wanted it to be a surprise.
Yeah, I'm guessing they just wanted it to be a surprise, but still just like, what?
Save the naming for dramatic tension.
It was a premature birth brought on by spaceship battle.
I've heard black holes will do that to a woman.
Maybe in the future you can just have a baby inside of a week, so, you know, this comes too fast.
Kirk's, you know, John Kirk's awful, his name is John, right, in the movie, Kirk's dad? Is it John or George?
It's actually Thor. We looked it up, it's the same actor, so maybe that's why he got born so quickly.
Yeah, maybe.
You know, he is the son of a god.
But anyway, he seemed, you know, like he was a pretty busy guy. Especially when his captain gives him orders to use autopilot, but he doesn't say what to use it for.
Whatever you're doing with this ship, use the autopilot when you do it. That's all I want from you.
When I was watching that again, that was a really weird series of orders that he gives, and it's like, and he's like, he's like, if I'm not back in 15 minutes, evacuate the ship, use autopilot. And it's like, for what? Are you telling me to ram this ship into the Narada? Because if so, I'd like something a little more specific.
You know what I think it was, is that he was telling him, don't stay behind on the ship. And then he has to, and even though I just watched it, I don't remember why, he actually has to stay on the ship because it...
They mentioned
the autopilot is broken.
The autopilot is broken, I guess.
The autopilot was just there to be like, okay, he's not necessarily going to die in this instance. And then it's taken away and we are so sad. Is.
You know, one thing that I saw watching this movie that I did not really notice the first time is Nero's second, who is a guy named Aiel, which you could very easily not ever know his name, because the only time it's ever said on screen, as far as I can tell, is when Nero is shouting it.
Aye.
And it sounds like he's just shouting, Aye! And you're like, what is that? And I only knew that was the name because of the subtitles.
The call of the wild Nero. Aye!
But that guy was actually pretty cool. I liked him.
The real villain.
He was much more threatening than Nero. And interestingly enough, he has most of the same lines. Like, he introduces himself in exactly the same way. He's very casual. He says hello. But he actually makes it work. And I don't know if this was a direction thing or Eric Bana just not knowing what to do with these lines. But Eric Bana either sounds like he's stoned or like he's trying to be Batman.
He's definitely trying to be Batman.
He has this, like, something... It's not always this way, so that's not what he always sounds like. But sometimes he puts on this very gravelly, fake voice, and he's like, I was there, I saw it, don't tell me it didn't happen.
I'm sorry to tell you this, guys, but that's what real men sound like. That's what we're into as the ladies.
Hello, Christopher. I'm Nero.
And I am stoned out of my gourd.
Honestly, this villain only works for me if he's absolutely insane, because all of his actions make no sense.
No.
I mean, especially right at the end where he's like, I would rather die and see Romulus destroyed again than accept help from you. It's like, okay, you are a man who, you see your world explode, and that obviously makes you sad, and I can see you being like vendetta against Spock, but if I was thrown back in time, the first thing I would do would suddenly be like, oh man, I'm gonna go warn them, I'm gonna start a whole thing to like make us prepare for this supernova. But no, he just sits there waiting, and actually his second in command doesn't ask him, so like, what's the plan, until 25 years later, right before Spock appears.
So I was just thinking, what's the plan? I've been holding my silence hoping you would bring it up, but 25 years, what's the plan?
Do we have a plan?
Do we do it? I was always interested by his train of logic, is that he has somehow saved Romulus by his actions. Like Spock is the cause of the first supernova.
Well, we've already established that the storyline of this movie makes no sense.
But he said it, so he's like, I'm stopping genocide. But how is he stopping it?
Well, that's the reason why I feel that he has to be insane.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that a really cool way to do this was if they had made it a cult instead, because, I mean, they wanted to have the tattoos, which is later explained to be mourning tattoos, even though...
Although, that's not in the movie. That's just...
Do your homework, and you will understand this movie better.
Although,
But then, even within the movie, it doesn't make sense, because his wife is wearing mourning tattoos, but she died, so why is she mourning?
He photoshopped them in.
Yeah,
or clearly. Maybe the supernova took some time to get there, and she ran to, like, a tattoo parlor real fast. It's like, I'm going to be dead soon. Put these on, so, and then I'll take a picture.
But like,
it'd be real puffy if she'd done that.
with the whole like setup, it really looks like they should be something more of a cult, because he's crazy. They're all dressing the same. They live in these hermited out like spaceship mining spaceship thing.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, if they had turned into a cult in response to their purpose as a cult was to seek revenge for Romulus. That would have been more sense-making.
It also would have explained why his second-in-command never questioned any of his crazy decisions.
I think what they could have done is if they had just taken a little more time to play with, say it would become the ship was a generational thing. Like, it was stuck out there for, like, I don't know, how long do Romulans live? Do they live as long as Vulcans?
Probably.
Yeah,
whatever. We're revamping. They're bald dudes now. Maybe they live less now. So maybe it's there for, like, maybe it got there 200 years, like, in the past from where Kirk is. And it's been, like, a generation or so.
Mm-hmm.
And all of this is instilled into these people. And so, like, they've been just kind of stuck between floating in between the stars, creating this cult. And I think that would have worked, you know? That would have made a little bit more sense for this weird vendetta that, for some reason, the rest of the crew is following. Especially when, like, he does the order where, like, we're going to shoot the ship, that if we shoot it, a black hole happens, so...
Mm-hmm.
Maybe we shouldn't shoot that
maybe
ship,
maybe we
guys.
Shouldn't shoot the black hole ship. It's full
but
of black
he
holes.
He has such good reasoning. He wants Spock dead now.
And, of course,
right
that
now.
Is just the... Like, that's one of my favorite plot holes in the movie, is, like, how did he capture it the first time? Did Spock just give up?
Spock, big coward.
I will let them have that. Because they say, we've been waiting for Spock for 25 years and planning. So I assume that at least the one thing that they did, other than just glaring into empty space, was creating a trap.
Maybe when they designed the black hole ship, they didn't put a self-destruct on it or something.
Well, but like, I mean, why didn't Spock... Like, old Spock, just turn around. What were they going to do at that point? Shoot him with torpedoes and cause a black hole?
I'm just saying,
mm-hmm.
There must have been a plan.
Yeah, probably.
Maybe a super tractor beam.
Or, you know, you could have just, like, Spock's a reasonable guy. We're going to shoot at you and then cause a giant black hole that might destroy, like, neighboring star systems. I could see Spock being like, okay, well, I'll submit and I'll come aboard and let's not be crazy about it. You can kill me. As long as you don't make black holes.
Let's be reasonable about this.
Yeah, I mean, again, that could have worked. Watching the movie again, I did still like most of the actors and most of the characters. I think that is still where the movie really shines, and I don't mean that ironically because it's really bright.
So much lens flare.
There are a lot of lens flares. And although, again, I will say that as much as I make fun of it for the lens flares, that's really just me jumping on the bandwagon. I did not notice the lens flares the first time I watched it. I knew everything was bright, but I did not specifically think, man, that's a lot of lens flares.
Yep.
Of course, I see them now. You can't not see them now.
I never had a problem with it. I didn't do what they were intending it to do, which was... There was a lot of things that were they trying to cement the universe into a reality, and having lens flare for them, they were trying to say, this is actually being shot with a camera, so like this is actually happening sort of thing, and that doesn't really work because lens flare is not quite as crazy as the lens flare that's in there, but I did like the... Basically, it was a cheat to make things look more futuristic to me.
Mm-hmm.
That's what it was about. And I didn't really mind it because it couldn't exactly go back to, you know, 1960s television.
Also, I was actually a big fan of a lot of the stylistic visual choices on this movie. I think a lot of that orangish lighting that is used really heavily in the movie really makes space feel scary.
Yeah.
Like, in the first scene where they introduce the Narada and they backlight it with a star... And so you have this orange dissipating into black. I don't know. In a lot of movies, space isn't a scary thing. It's just where the thing is happening. Even Star Trek, too. You know, when I see the Enterprise D flying through space, I'm not scared of the space. But the movie managed to make space scary.
Well, this movie was very good at external, like, silhouette shots. Mm-hmm. Like, there are a number of shots of, like, it zooms out and there's the Narada, which is enormous, and, like, it sometimes has, like, like the Enterprise or the little Vulcan squid ship and, like, torpedoes flying towards it, and it looks really cool, and I definitely appreciate it for that. I also very much like the debris field, and the other Federation ships in general look really cool. Mm-hmm. Go ahead, Lily.
I will say that there's a lot of visuals I liked about it. I definitely like the way they treated the actors. I felt that the makeup and, like, the small details, like Uhura's bitchin' and rad earrings.
Yes.
Which is one thing that, to me, that was really important about her character. Don't entirely ask me why. I just always liked that in original series. A problem I have with their visual choice is basically how they decide to treat the mining ship.
Oh, where it
really seemed like there was, like, some bizarre argument or miscommunication going on where it's like, okay, the villains are going to be miners, and this is, like, where they're set up. And so they created a mine-like feeling. It's like, no. This is not a mine. This is a mining ship. Oh, okay. So we're going to have a giant drill. So they make this giant drill. No, it's a laser drill. So they put the laser at the bottom
of this drill.
Of this drill. Laser drill. It's just like, guys.
Well, my thought, for at least the exterior, the interior I don't have really any excuse for. But the exterior of the ship is, in the comic, the reason the Narada looks the way it does is because of Borg nanite technology that they souped up a Romulan mining vessel with to make it look that way. But it doesn't look like any Borg ship we've ever seen before. Borg ships are very efficient in their design, like, you know, a cube or a sphere or a tablet thing we see in one Voyager episode. So my thought on the Narada and its design of how it came to be that way is that we know nanites can interface with people. So my explanation for this is that the nanites interfaced with Nero in some capacity, and his shattered psyche of revenge and all those negative feelings he felt basically crafted how the nanites would modify his ship and created this really terrifying visage of spiky, just random, just crap, basically, to make this ship look as imposing and scary as possible. And it doesn't make any sense. Like his revenge plot makes no fucking sense. It's not useful for anything other than being scary.
It's going along the lines of the crazy, so I'm down for it.
So
hold on, guys. Just for reference, I called up a picture, and no one outside the podcast, listening to the podcast, can see it. But I called up a picture of what the Narada looked like before it got all Borgified. Now, from the Countdown comics, doesn't that look like the Bebop from Cowboy Bebop? I'm not crazy, am I? That kind of looks like the Bebop.
No, looks like the Bebop.
Can you pull up a Bebop now?
All right. It looks pretty reasonable. Like, I don't, like, the drill still looks kind of funny hanging down below it, but, you know.
It's a laser drill.
It's a laser
drill. Bebop. Here's a shot. There's a shot from the side. Let's see if I can find an exterior shot from the outside.
Warren, you're bad at this. These are nothing like the...
Quiet, you.
This Google page looks nothing like the Narada.
All right, there you go. There's one. There's a good shot of it. Doesn't it look kind of like the...
Why are you making it so tiny?
It only comes in tininess. It's not a big picture.
It's not... All yeah, right. It's got the go two back, little side bits.
Go back to the other thing. Yeah, sure.
Yeah. See, it's this long brown thing with two little things on the side, and I'm telling you, it's the Bebop.
I mean, I wouldn't mind them being the Bebop. This is the future of the Bebop. It gets turned into a Romulan mining ship.
Yeah. I will say that a mining ship, to me, like, unless there's two forms of mining ships where it's like, this guy's the driller, and this guy's the one who actually picks up all this stuff, I would assume they would actually have more room to put minerals and the things that they're mining.
Well, see, here's my thing. This is what I assumed the design of the ship was originally supposed to be before they decided it was a Borg design, because I don't think that was in the original script of the movie. I'm pretty positive that the reason the ship is supposed to look the way it is the idea that all those arms and stuff are supposed to be for grabbing asteroids and, like, feeding them into that maw thing, which is supposed to be, like, the asteroid processor, and it kind of is reminiscent of the Doomsday Machine from TOS. Now, they never...
I honestly think that from listening to them talk, I think they just thought it would be cool.
Yeah, probably.
This would be really cool, guys.
At the inside of the ship, you can kind of justify it by being like, well, it's a mining ship. It needs to have a giant cargo bay. But except it gets stupid because their bridge is over this enormous open pit.
Well, yeah, there don't seem to be any rooms or corridors. It's just all, like, open platforms.
It looks to me like that they actually had to reformat their bridge. Like, they had to pull everything apart. Somehow their bridge got destroyed because I don't remember exactly, but I'm pretty sure that they had wires running through puddles.
Yes, they had standing water everywhere, and then they had electronic cables
running through. They moved through the black hole, it like sucked up parts of the ship, and that's where the big like tubes come from, like the big holes that everyone falls into. Those are just, there used to be a ship there, but the black hole ate it. It was like very selective black hole. It Swiss cheesed the ship.
They were just trying to reference Star Wars. Like, the creators of this, they really want to reference Star Wars as much, like, a lot throughout.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't blame them. I don't like it, but I don't blame them.
I mean, they weren't doing themselves any favors with that, I think, because there are a number of Star Trek fans who live in constant fear that J.J. Abrams hates Star Trek and just wants to turn it into Star Wars. And I don't think that they were not helping to assuage those fears by talking about all these Star Wars references they wanted to make in the commentary.
Were they? I didn't
Yeah, they talked about a couple of those. Mm-hmm. I mean, the most blatant one is probably the Spock, scares off a monster.
Mm-hmm.
By the way, let's talk about that scene. What the fuck is up with that scene? What is going on with Kirk being chased by monsters? If I had to pick a part of the movie that I actually, like, legit did not like, just straight up, it's that entire sequence.
It was weird, because, like, it had a big prey that it had killed, I assumed, and then it chased Kirk.
Huh. Our fan is spazzing out.
Weird. And it chased Kirk instead, and it, like, I saw the big spindly limbs on that thing, and it must weigh a lot. And then it tumbles down this really steep slope. I was expecting it to be dead after that. Because all those spindly limbs would have been crushed underneath its own weight. Like, it just didn't seem like a body that could sustain that kind of fall.
I kind of enjoyed that scene just being there because it's, like, the only way that they can sort of shoehorn in a reference to Kirk used to fight baddies on Alien Worlds.
Yeah.
Because he roughed it.
Yeah, I guess. I mean, I do appreciate all of the interesting little homages to the original series. Like, I really like... Well, first of all, I really like that Captain Pike is in it. I forgot to mention that. But that is something that I really loved about this movie, was that it had Captain Pike. Because Pike is a character that I think doesn't get enough love in Star Trek continuity, and I thought it worked very well. I really loved when the first shot of Pike on the bridge has that weird little, like, eye lighting on him. Because that is such a goofy thing from the original series that they did all the time for some reason. And I thought that was a really nice little homage. But the monster sequence, I just can't handle the monster sequence.
I just let it flow over me.
And the fact that Spock just happens to be there, and...
They said that's destiny. That's how they saw it.
Yeah, that was how they... It's funny listening to the commentary, because they're talking about how they didn't know how to explain how Spock just happened to be on this planet, and their final explanation was, fuck it, we don't care.
Well,
he just did it.
It just happened.
I know that they didn't actually have a reason, but my logic would be that... Both Nero and Spock were having, the young Spock, were having the same idea of, I want to put this person somewhere uncomfortable, and we're near
Delta Vega.
Vulcan.
Yeah, I guess.
Like, this is a planet that's right next to Vulcan, because Vulcan just got ate, and that's where they were. So it had to have a view of Vulcan, and it had to be a place that was not comfortable for them to be, but survivable enough.
Right. And I guess Scotty also happened to be there with some kind of rock gnome.
I love the rock gnome.
I like Scotty and the rock gnome, although now, thanks to all of the Doctor Who I've been watching, every line I heard Scotty read was just, I just replaced him with Matt Smith. And just imagine the Doctor wandering around, because he seems like he's on something, or just so ignorant of what everyone else is doing. It's just I just imagine him just being secretly a Time Lord.
Now,
can I get a towel?
My feeling on Scotty is interesting, because on the one hand, Scotty is probably the least like the character that he originally was. Like, Simon Pegg's Scotty is nothing like Scotty was originally. Like, not even kind of. But I don't care. I like Scotty, and I'm alright with it, because... Honestly, original Scotty, no disrespect to James Doohan, but original Scotty wasn't that interesting. Like, in the original series, Scotty is kind of boring, and it's only in the movies when they start to exaggerate his character that he finally starts to get interesting. And, of course, in Relics. He's very good in Relics. But, like, just the original Scotty's not that cool, and since they're hypercharging everything in this movie, you know, little Red Letter Media reference there, I understand that they, and, you know, when you hire an actor like Simon Pegg, you're going to get a very distinct personality, because that's kind of how Simon Pegg makes his living.
Well, so, but he really tried. No, he really brought his game to
he did. No, again, I like it. Even though it isn't the same, I definitely approve of it. And now I'm excused every time I complain about something that was different. Because I
Oh, something that was different that I kind of like that a bunch of people hate. Engine Room. Like the new Engine Room. I'm a fan.
I just don't like how big it is.
I like the idea.
So big!
But, like, I like it because, like, they call the lower section of the ship the drive section. But engineering is, like, a room. This is one room. The drive section's really big. Even if the warp core is the whole, like, height of the drive section. The drive section isn't very tall. It's only, I don't know how many decks it is, but not that many.
A few.
So, a few. So, like, the warp core runs the entire height of it, but it is still only one room. I like the idea of the entire drive section being an engine room. Engine rooms are big. That's where the engines live.
Yeah, okay.
Apparently the nacelles are kind of hollow that you can walk inside, so not much engine lives in the nacelles, so...
Yeah, Lillian?
This just is, it's related to that. I really appreciated the fact that they tried to use as many locations as possible, mainly because when you watch a lot of, like, especially talking about Star Wars again, if you look at the Star Wars prequels, one of the things that really hurts them is that the actors kind of are, like, not... They don't have a place of reference, so they really don't have a thing to get into.
No, definitely.
Where it's like, the even the scene where Spock is saying, hey, Mom, are you cool with me becoming, like, a Vulcan scientist versus the Federation, whatever. It's shot in a church. Like, that's an actual church that exists, and they just put a giant, like, green thing on the outside of it so they could, like, put Vulcan on the... through the windows.
Right.
And I'm just like, that is really, really cool.
No, I agree. I think that is a really good thing.
Yep.
And I applaud Abrams for that decision.
And Budweiser.
And Budweiser. And yep. I mean, I'll admit, I don't hate the new engineering. It just does bother me because it's so big.
Yeah, I'm...
I'm also not sure what those brewery tanks are for.
They're for brewing our engine beer.
They are filled
you
to
know
Budweiser.
What they're, you know what they're for now that Scotty's running the engine room?
Well, yeah, I guess.
You know how it is. I enjoyed the new engine room. Its ceiling was a little high.
Yeah, there was a lot. I think I would have been more okay with it if there was less empty space.
But the price of on location, I take it as that. Maybe that's where, like, the invisible fields live. I don't know.
Probably.
It's where something invisible lives in the engine room now.
One thing that was kind of, like, a thing that's different, and this isn't really I don't think it was a conscious change. This was just sort of a happenstantial change. Like, the actress who played Uhura, which maybe you know the name of, I don't.
Zoe Saldana. Zoe Saldana.
I really liked her facial structure. It was very similar, and I felt that she brought a really good attitude. But I really wish they'd gone with someone more buff, because one of the few things that we know about Uhura is that she is ripped. Mm-hmm. Like, she is a muscular chick, and unfortunately, Zoe's not.
No, that was the thing that bothered me about her, was that her arms are so skinny. I'm just watching it, and they're not always that skinny. I've seen her in other movies, and she doesn't always have arms like twigs, but in that movie she did. I mean, Uhura is probably the only character I didn't like in some capacity, because really she's there and she does do the message thing, but that's mainly Kirk's scene. And then, like, they bring her on the bridge because she can translate Romulan and Vulcan, but that never comes up as important. But
the thing for me, like, I like certain things about Uhura and I don't like certain things about it. I was really upset when I first realized she was the girl, the one that, you know, Kirk is going to go after.
Yeah.
And then I was, like, happy that she ended up being Spock's girl, so that at least it was that. But at the same time, like, she's the only girl main character. Couldn't she just be one of, like, the main cast? Couldn't she just be another sidekick.
I mean, they bring her on the bridge, and then she basically has nothing to do except be Spock's romance interest.
Thanks to that, I feel she had more to do than Sulu. Sulu did almost nothing this movie. Like, I'm trying to think of the scene Sulu is in. After the drill scene, he's really in nothing more than just announcing a status report. Scotty was only in maybe like the latter third of the movie, and he did more.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, with Sulu, I understand the direction they chose to go with Sulu. I'm not entirely happy about it because I feel it runs counter to a lot of the ground that George Takei broke when he was playing Sulu originally. Because his big thing was that he wanted Sulu to be more of an action character, which was very difficult for Asians to get at the time. Asians were typically, you know, you're almost like non-gendered martial arts character or some kind of wizened mentor. And Sulu wanted to be more like a cowboy, Takei wanted to be more like a cowboy, and I thought that worked very well. Again, I was very happy that he used a fencing foil in TOS, and that's one of the reasons why the katana in this movie bothers me. I mean, the fold-out part is also bothersome, because I think it looks kind of stupid, and I wish he'd either just had a regular katana, or it had been like a, you know, extendo metal katana.
Well, it's funny because basically George Takei was like, in this fantasy sequence where he's acting crazy, he's like, I don't want to have katana because that's racist. And then here it's like, no, this is not, you know, Sulu being crazy. This is Sulu on the job using a katana. It's like, wow, racial stereotype again.
And the funny thing is he doesn't even use it right. Like, he stabs with it. That's not what a katana is for. You don't stab with a katana. Or at least you shouldn't.
I personally didn't feel that upset by how they treated each of the characters, giving or not giving enough time to them, because I thought they were pretty good at giving, you know, really small chunks where you, like, got to know the character and it was important, but didn't stay on it too much because that would have made a really, really long film that we couldn't get through.
Well, I mean, you know, despite they're not getting a huge amount of screen time, Sulu and Chekhov had more to do in this movie than they did in Star Trek 1 and 5 put together.
Yeah.
So, you know, I'm not unhappy with them. And I obviously, Bones, Carl Urban as McCoy is the best.
I think the two best actors in this of the main cast were Zachary Quinto.
Quinto.
Spock. Spock and McCoy.
The two best actors. Watching Zachary Quinto as Spock is interesting for me because every once in a while I'll get kind of annoyed by how kind of, I mean, just emotional he seems to get. And then I remember, okay, this is young Spock. He still hasn't quite gotten his hand around things.
Also, to be fair, we're comparing him against, like, the Spock that is now. Like, watching original TOS Spock, especially early TOS Spock.
Yeah, he didn't know what he was doing.
He is not the Spock that we all know and love today.
No, he smiles at flowers and yells a lot. And
yeah, that just isn't... The Spock that we know is this weird amalgamation of an actual character and then, like, Nimoy, like, and his personal poise and his books and all the various things that have grown up around Spock.
I'm actually more upset. Like, I think that Zach did fine with what he was given, but the writers and just the creators of this really threw Vulcan in a direction that I didn't like. And
yeah.
I guess it's kind of good because now it's dead. But,
yeah, I really feel like they got their inspiration for Vulcans by watching Enterprise.
It's just weird to me because when you look at Vulcan, like, if we're going to make it modern day, there's nothing wrong with taking, like, Buddhist monk type stuff and putting it in there, because to me that's what Vulcans are always about, meditating and having control over their emotions. And even when Spock's father is telling him, like, hey, like, we are actually a really emotional race too, somehow Spock gets out of that, like, you're telling me to be all Vulcan and no human. It's like, he just told you that Vulcans have more emotions than humans, and you're like, na-na-na-na-na. But to me, the children bully scene was just completely unrealistic, not just because of bad child actors, but because that type of society, I think that Spock would be coming up against the adults around him.
Yeah.
And, like, basically people treating him as if he was lesser, but not in a bullying sort of way, because that doesn't make sense for Vulcan.
Yeah, and I mean, that scene is, like, inspired by a scene from the animated series, but it's just way over the top.
I do like the idea of the Vulcan children all sitting down and, like, having a council to come up with these insults, because insults aren't really in the Vulcan vernacular, so, like, they're all sitting down and trying to come up with the best ways to, like, yeah, we'll call his mom, a bad, no, a whore, yeah, that, one of those, I've read about those, are bad. We're going to come and show it to him tomorrow, it'll be great.
And then, where did the kids learn about that? Because to me, Vulcan children are so much more disciplined than our children, so it's like they have to figure out, you know, what's a bad human word, and then Spock also has to know about this in the context.
And, like, I was kind of bothered by the fact that the Vulcan Science Academy, like, basically brought Spock there so that they could insult him.
No, like, I didn't see it that way. I saw it as they were like, hey, you got into the academy, and good for you. And then when they said, like, it's really impressive that you did this in spite of being half human, and because of your half human mom, he's like, I'm going to go to the
right. That just struck me as something that I didn't feel like they would say that.
Yeah, it's
at
like
that point.
I thought that was much more honest than what the children did.
Yeah, but it's like going to, like, to defend your dissertation for, like, a PhD, and they'll being like, you did a very good job on your PhD, despite the fact that you were legally retarded. Like,
yeah.
that's kind of what I imagine, because these guys are supposed to be, like, the, like, intellectual elite, and I just can't imagine a school anywhere telling anyone that in, like, a public setting. Just being like, you were kind of dumb, but congrats anyway.
I feel that it's more like they don't see their own racism yet. Like, they just are at
right.
the point where they accept humans as not being as cultured as Vulcans and a younger race than Vulcans. So they kind of just... It's like us talking about... when we talk about previous civilizations, we always sort of it's like, oh, it's really impressive for what they did, you know, during that time period, despite... their limitations. Like, to me, that always comes off wrong.
Mm-hmm.
I can't really get into, like, the entire parade as to why, but essentially that there's... We always survive in the way that we can, and so, like, it's dumb to think that people that are in the past were actually stupider. They just had different tools than we did.
Yeah. I mean, mainly what it was just we had basically two scenes to acquaint us with Vulcan, and neither scene made me sad when Vulcan blew up.
Also, Vulcan had the very logical upside-down cities.
Hey, you give upside-down cities alone. I liked upside-down
cities.
Those
are very logical that we would build these cities upside-down when there are these huge swaths of empty planet to build on. I saw them. I saw them in other shots.
To be fair, Vulcan, like, while being all about logic, I think that they were also a very artistic, like, based society, at least from the original series and... other things that we've seen. They do mm-hmm. like their art. They don't think art's unlogical.
I just would like the idea, this would be really hard to pull off because it would be hard to do it without being boring, is have very simplistic architecture for Vulcan. Do, like, you know, there's elegance and logic, and it's illogical to add all this crap onto our buildings, but that's really hard to pull off because art is very, you know, personal.
Subjective,
yeah.
context sensitive.
Exactly, and it's easier to be, you know, like
well,
really grandiose architecture is much more likely for people to enjoy as a group.
Flying buttresses.
Yeah, flying buttresses are awesome.
Honestly,
also funny.
When we tried to go in that direction, like on Earth, it sucked.
Yeah, it's really hard to do right is the problem.
And I mean, mainly what it was for me is this is just a case where I think the movie maybe would have benefited by being a little more stereotypical in this instance of, if you're going to blow something up, first, make me care about it a little bit.
Yes, let's have a panning shot of
and,
the beautiful,
you know, like,
meadows and
I don't
cities
know, have some Vulcan children,
cities.
Like, frolicking in a meadow or something. I don't know.
We can go to the Vulcan puppy factory.
I just wanted to, especially because the last couple of years of Star Trek were really unkind to Vulcans. And I did like Spock's dad. I thought Spock's dad did a very good job. I forget who was playing him. Even though Sarek will always be, in some ways I associate Sarek with his actor more than I associate Spock with Nimoy, but I thought they did a very good job there. It's like the same thing with Spock's mom. Like, you'll notice that to make us care about Spock's mom, they don't show her being a huge bitch and then drop her off a cliff. And, you know, that scene is a little bit telegraphed when she falls off a cliff, but whatever. That's just what it comes down to, is I wanted a slightly more flattering look at Vulcan. I wanted to feel like we lost something. And obviously I have the, you know, I felt like we lost something because I have experienced Vulcan in other ways. But I don't know. That's my own beef.
Also, why did they have to drop the black hole in the center of the planet?
Oh, gonna work up that.
I understand how black holes work a little bit. You could just put one next to the planet and that would probably deal with it.
The thing that I find wonderful about the red goo and basically the entire premise of like the plot is when Spock explains how he had to get a bunch of red matter in order to stop the supernova, and then the unthinkable happened.
And then the thing we knew that was gonna happen.
No, it's not even like the thing we knew was gonna happen. It's like I was late.
I'm very punctual normally. It's unthinkable that I could have
the unthinkable
be late.
Happened. I overslept.
And when he like shows up and we see the inside of his ship, all I can think is, Spock, why did you get so much? I mean, maybe you would have been on time if you hadn't been looking for all this red matter, or maybe...
Weighed his ship down. Red matter weighed too much. Move at half speed.
Why didn't we just bring a ship we already had instead of building a new one?
Red matter.
We have some pretty
fast...
Maybe it's a
something.
Red matter containment unit and with an engine on the back.
Yeah.
Maybe they already had the engine. They just had to make a containment unit.
See, I can totally believe that. I just would think that if you need a drop of red matter, that's how much you would bring to the party.
Brought more. He brought some for the entire class.
Yeah, he brought enough to basically endlessly make black holes wherever you needed it. Maybe he was thinking of like long-term contingency of like, you know, there's going to be other supernovas. I mean, there's going to be supernovas for basically forever, so I just need like almost an infinite amount.
Isn't he going to need more to deal with all
for
these
some
supernovas?
Reason the supernova is wiping out all the galaxy. What? I mean, nothing about that
trying
story.
Trying to threaten all the galaxy.
Nothing about that story makes any sense, and the fact that it's delivered through a giant info dump is even worse.
Captain's log.
I mean, it's just that entire sequence. I'm just sitting there going like,
One thing that I'm really amused by was that the creators, were like. They said the thing that I always knew, but it's just like, this is the scene where, like, Kirk really sees that they have feelings. And, like, yeah, he has a, like, a headache. And it's like, so you do feel. It's like, that is special. That's your epiphany right there.
You feel so much.
It's like, I just kind of wish that they took, like, half a second to make Kirk cry. Like, this is Vulcan emotions, which are supposed to be bigger.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not just like Vulcan emotions that are, or even if you're just doing human emotions, everyone you know is dead. I think if someone like just transferred that emotion to me, I wouldn't be able to be like, oh, my head kind of hurts. Ow.
Yeah, I think I would
so
be weeping.
He ain't no Patrick Stewart.
Considering how strong we know Spock's emotions are, I think if some of that was transferred into me, I think I just would have been bawling on the floor. But speaking of Kirk, I want to talk about Kirk. I did like Chris Pine as Kirk. I thought he did a fine job. But I have a nitpick, and I think this will qualify as the minorest of nitpicks that we've made so far about this movie. Something that really annoyed me is that sequence with the green girl, right? Mm-hmm. That Kirk is all, like, getting up on and being like, oh, man, we're going to kisses. And then she mentions that she needs to stop bringing guys home. And Kirk is like, how many guys have you brought home? And I was like, fuck you, Kirk.
Okay.
Your entire thing is that you sleep around and you're going to give her a hard time?
The thing that I thought was funny about that was because, like, they're making out. She says, I think I'm in love with you. And he says, that's weird. And then she is like, oh, I told my roommate that I stopped bringing guys home. So he's like, how many guys are you bringing over? I mean, she just said, I love you, and is upset at him for not being like, oh, I love you too, baby.
I just think that Kirk knows he's kind of an asshole. He's like, why would you love me? I'm so confused by this.
I thought Kirk's reaction to that line was perfect.
Yeah, that was great. I don't think that him judging her after her being like incensed that he didn't immediately be like, I love you back.
Also, it's the pheromones, because she's an Orion woman, from what I can tell. And I've seen them in a couple of episodes. It's, you know, you gotta get inoculated against that.
Yeah, and I also thought it was really weird that Uhura immediately started stripping down.
Apparently, that was because they thought it was gonna be funny.
Did they?
Yeah.
Is that what it said in the commentary?
Yes, they said that originally she was not gonna get undressed, and then he was like, but them, all three of them in their underwear just seemed so comical. And one of the other people were like, oh, so is that how you're going to justify that, huh? So, you know.
I just assume that's what women do when they're alone together in rooms. They just take off all their clothes.
Like, immediately.
Like, immediately. The first thing that you do is just off of clothes.
I mean, at the very least, that, like, gave her a real reason to be pissed off that he was there.
Yeah, also the fact that he was trying to, like, sneak a peek kind of bothered me, too. I was not fond of that. I never saw Kirk as a voyeur.
Well, you know, Kirk does what he wants.
Apparently. But to talk about something that, again, that I did like, I liked the, there was a couple of instances where they would go outside into space, and then they all sound would stop, and I liked that. I thought that was a nice little homage to there being no sound in space, because obviously you can't have an entire space opera movie with no sound in space.
Yeah, they were going to do that originally, but then they felt that that was bad.
Yeah, they can't, they can't do that. I understand. I would love it if they did, but people would hate it. Mm-hmm. So I understand why they don't, and I appreciated the homages. Thank you for that.
They brought in the guy who did Star Wars soundscapes to do their soundscape, which is another reason why I think I'm like, Star Wars.
Also, I like the way the phasers worked in this one.
Yeah, they struck.
It gave the fights a much more immediate feel to it, especially in the scene where it's shooting down the Narada's missiles.
Yeah, they gave it. It had like a souped up feel of the phasers from Wrath of Khan. It's kind of what it looked like.
More actiony.
Yeah, which is, again, I do like that, and for the most part, I liked the redesign of the Enterprise. The only thing I didn't like about it was the nacelles are kind of fat. If you look at it from the side, they're awful fat.
Also, I noticed on Sulu's console, on, like, the top, there's, like, two joysticks. Or, I think they're joysticks. I'm not sure what they are, but they look like things you hold with your hands. But they're at a place where you'd have to, like, be either standing up or, like, leaning over really far.
Well, that's the serious
joystick. Oh, when shit gets real, you lean over your console to grab the real joysticks.
And then you're in a dramatic position and everything.
I was just wondering what they were for. I was just, I don't know. Ooh. I was okay. I liked pretty much everything about the new Enterprise. I also liked the line, punch it. I'm a fan.
Yeah.
It ain't really Star Trek, but I liked it.
Yeah, you said punch it. Whatever. I'm okay with that. And the bridge is, I liked the view screen, and I liked the fact, I liked the focus on having more consoles displaying more information. I wasn't a big fan of how white everything was. That kind of bothered me, but that's just because, again, it felt like it was a little too bright. You know, I give Voyager and Enterprise crap for turning off all the lights during emergencies.
We need lots of reflective surfaces.
But I feel like this new movie went the opposite direction. People are going to have a hard time seeing with everything so bright in there.
I always ask the crew, how can you see around all this lens flare? There's too much lens flare on this ship.
One thing that, just as a concept, I didn't really like was that I didn't like that we got to meet all these people as students, and then immediately they are at the positions that we later know them as. Like, yeah. I don't have, like, a perfect solution up my sleeve, but it just bugged me, because I'm like, I feel like this is, you know, not taking it seriously, that you're just sort of slapping all these people.
I admit I'm a little confused as to why they decided to set this movie so early in Kirk's career. I feel like that was a misstep on their part, and I don't know if it gained them anything. I know that because they wanted to show the crew when they were first meeting, and I feel like they could have done that and had them still be adults and been more credible, and that whole, like, gathering the party, as it were, before venturing forth, would have made a lot more sense if Kirk had been because we established Kirk was promoted to captain fairly young. And, you know, it's a retcon. They've changed. It's a reboot. They've changed the timeline. He could be even younger this time. He could be serving under Pike as his, like, legit first officer, a very young first officer.
It kind of cheapens the entire thing that basically Kirk is there because Pike really liked his dad.
Yeah.
I mean, that just seems like bad nepotism, bad placement, bad timing.
It sort of struck me as, like, a pup named Scooby-Doo. And, like, a pup named Scooby-Doo is, like, is intentional, like, spoofing of itself. It's making fun of Scooby-Doo. It's not supposed to be a serious reboot.
I mean, it almost a more logical way to have done this is to basically do, is it called, like, Red Flag or whatever? The troop of elite Starfleet
students. Red Squad.
Red Squad.
Red Squadron.
That, like, would have been interesting.
If they had all been young and were out on, like, a training mission and then found out about this thing that was going on, mm-hmm. and instead of it being the flagship that was piloted by students for no goddamn reason. Like, we would have a reason for all of them.
Yeah, apparently the entire fleet was in this one system. That confused me. I mean, I get that they had to explain why the rest of Starfleet wasn't there, but they were all in one system.
They were doing something.
So far, the best solution I've heard within the that would have worked within the confines of the movie was SF Debris. Was the montage at the end showing Kirk and the crew and, like, the main cast doing all these various things, and then it would jump.
Yeah.
Maybe a year or two forward, and it would be him sitting in the captain's chair. That's the best one I've heard. I can't come up with anything better without heavily reworking the structure of the movie.
I mean, you could even just have him being appointed to the captain's chair, like, just thrown, like, but, say, like, 10 years later or whatever. Like, you didn't have to have it, got back, and...
Yeah, I know that one of the things they talked about in interviews is that they want the next movie to take place basically right after the last one because they want to have the crew work out their differences because their goal is that they didn't really work out all their differences in this movie. They just had to put them aside briefly to have this crisis. And so, I mean, at least they're following up on it. At least they're not just like, you're being like, all right, they're a crew now. And that's something that I appreciate.
One thing that I remember from the commentary that I don't know why it made me think of it, but it's kind of crude and upsetting, is it's the scene with the underwear mishap. They talked about how, like, because he gets up and immediately starts being interested in what she was talking about, is showing that he's actually interested in her.
Is it?
Yeah, and that's just like... I mean, I think even the actor knows that he's trying to, like, stay in the room with hot naked ladies. I mean...
Good evening.
I don't blame a guy for doing that. I don't. I mean, I'm not quite as forward as that, but maybe if I was in a room with two sexy guys or two sexy girls and I just, like, I wanted to stay, I would,
Fast talk.
Fast talk. I'm trying to fast talk into staying.
I am very interested in your rolls the dice. Transmissions!
Yeah. I did want to say one more thing about his quick promotion to captain before we move on to the next one.
Yeah, yeah.
I think a handicap for this is that the Starfleet ranking system is so weird because in, like, other navies and stuff, you can captain a ship without being a captain.
Oh, yeah.
Like, you can captain, like, a destroyer in a navy and be, like, I don't know, whatever's below captain. Yeah, a lieutenant. Lieutenant commander or something like that. Also, there's the rank of Commodore, which kind of exists in some navies and not in others, that's between captain and flag rank.
I was looking up Commodore, just as a complete tangent, and Commodore is such a confusing rank, because, like, we used it up until the 1880s, and then we got rid of it, and then we reinstated it in, like, World War II for some reason, and then we brought it, and then we got rid of it again, but then, by that point, just common stance just a tradition to refer to senior captains in a squadron as the Commodore because they were the one giving the orders. And then we brought it back in the 1980s, but that confused everybody because there were the actual Commodores and then there were the captains that everyone called Commodore and they got really confused. So they changed it again to, and I think this is what it is now, is Admiral Commodore. I think is what
that
the rank is.
Solves everything.
And it is such a confusing history of a rank.
Maybe it could have been like, you know, like Commander, because Commander's below captain, you'd be like Commander Kirk's son serving under Commodore Pike or something like that.
Yeah, but they can't have him be not a captain and being in charge of the Enterprise. Can't do it.
But
although, I mean, I don't know.
Starfleet's ranking system, I think it would have, if we had a real ranking system for navies in the Star Trek, it would have been a little bit easier. Although, could have captained something.
Although, wait, I have another even sillier nitpick. Is when Pike tells him to get into Starfleet, he says, enlist in Starfleet. And I was like, he used the wrong verb.
Enroll.
He meant to say enroll in Starfleet, because he isn't joining as a crewman, he's joining as an officer. He's going to officer school.
It's really vague what he's doing.
He's doing something. They're talking about him being an officer.
It's really vague what he was supposed to be, because we know what Bones is. He's a doctor. He's a medical, probably a mid-ranking med officer. We know what Uhura is, what everyone else's job is, and they're all, at least several of them are in the same year as Kirk, but we just don't know what Kirk was. I assume he's on the tactical command track.
Probably.
Kirk is just amazing at everything.
Like, would he have been the TAC officer on board another ship?
Who knows?
No, he was just there to become captain. That was the only thing he
I took the be captain path when the normal captain dies. That's the path of Starfleet command that I took.
Or when they get greatly injured because, you know, it's the future.
You want to talk about command. You want to talk about the Kobayashi Maru sequence? Because, again, that sequence was just kind of painful
while I was watching it.
It's sort of like... It was painful while I was watching it, and then I heard Spock's explanation for the test, and I was kind of like, no, okay. Now I kind of understand why Kirk is being so flippant, because this test is stupid.
Yep. Yeah.
It's like you experience fear in this simulation.
Well, you know, Star Trek has a history of, like, thinking simulations can make people experience, like, legitimate emotions like that, like where Deanna Troi has to try send fake Geordi to his death. It's like... That doesn't prove you could send someone to their death. It proves you can send a hologram to a simulated death. I can do that now. I don't think I could order someone to go die.
But they did it right in that early episode with Wesley, and I can't believe I'm referencing something Wesley did as a positive example, but they did it right because Wesley didn't know it was a test. It was a super secret test.
That would have been a better way. You couldn't have it really as a standard thing, but...
No. Yeah, you couldn't retake it.
What, did they ever explain exactly what the point of the Kobayashi Maru was? It was just to give them an unbeatable scenario?
Yeah, I mean, in the original way it was presented, it was basically to, I mean, it was to make you, it was to see how captains dealt with a no-win scenario, and to basically test your responses in the face of ever-increasing odds. That's what it was.
Which is completely
fair. Which is something you can do with the simulation.
But then they decided to make it that the purpose was to experience fear. And
Basically, putting Spock in that position.
Yeah, making Spock explain that. And Zachary Quinto is trying. He is trying to sell
my test is dumb.
And he's just like, it's just not working.
Deal with my stupid test. We have a treaty with Spock that we have to use a stupid test.
Like, it really disappointed me because the Kobayashi Maru was something that I was always really kind of interested in. Like, if you're going to do it, you have to do it well, and it's sad that they botched up. And I also am not entirely comfortable with Spock in a teacher's position, not just because of what they chose to do with it in that respect, but then deciding that he met Uhura and through being her teacher. I mean, why the hell did they have to do that?
Oral sensitivity.
Yeah, like, you could have easily had that same scene of her just, like, him happening to be the officer who's choosing where she's going, and him being like, I don't want to seem favoritism. She didn't have to be his student. That's just gross.
Or maybe he could have been, like, the equivalent of TA, like, a student who has been, like, good enough to work, like, kind of, like, on the side. Because, like, that's something I see in where I go to school. Where, students and TAs will sometimes get together because they're around the same age. You know, they're both still learning things.
Well, he's not the same age as her, and I'm fine with that. I'm just not okay with them being in a position where he was her teacher and she was the student. And then
that does put
together.
A creepy vibe on
their
relationship.
I mean, it's not allowed now for students to get involved with teachers, like, within a few years of them, like, having a class with them. Like, it's just not okay.
Now it's K.
Well, Starfleet said it's K. It's not specifically students. It's teachers that are supposed to wait a period of a few years.
Yeah.
So the creep factor wears off.
The creep's on a cooldown.
Oopah.
Okay, so... Let's see. What else is there in this movie to talk about?
I can do the live long and prosper sign better than Spock can.
Oh yeah, Zachary Quinto. That scene with him in the end where he does that is just sad.
He's trying so hard, and it just makes me feel.
Oh, here's something interesting. Go ahead, Lily.
No. You do your thing because I want to talk about the end.
Is a little bit about the end. This is just a little trivia. I heard in the commentary their explanation for why the black hole sometimes blows you
That's
up,
what
and
I
sometimes
talk
takes
about.
You home.
Like, yeah. Before we actually say that part, because that's the explanation to the problem. I mean, even when I first watched it, like, I enjoyed the movie when I first watched it. It was one of those things where I'm like, I am actually having fun watching this movie. But that scene where they first are like, hey, would you like to be saved? We can save you. And then the response of... our bad guy being crazy beyond crazy, like them shooting pot shots at them just completely delegitimizes all of what they've done. They are supposed to have matured, and now they are firing at a ship that's being swallowed by a black hole.
And then they
get stuck.
I just imagine,
because they did that.
I just imagine a bunch of nerds sitting around the table and the GM's behind his screen. They're like, we want to shoot at him now. And the GM's like, are you sure? The black hole's right. No, we're going to shoot at him. It's going to be great. Okay, the black hole starts to eat you.
No, I think what I think.
Like, oh crap!
No, it might even have been the reverse. Yeah. The GM was like, the black hole starts sucking you in, and they're like, what? We try to escape, and before it gets us, and like, you can't. The black hole has already got you.
Okay,
like,
we just want to shoot him.
Can we at least shoot at Nero's ship while the black hole is getting
us? Shoot him down.
Like, I remember literally, like, under my breath, yelling at the characters, being like, no, get away, it's a black hole, it's a giant black hole, you don't know how big it's gonna be.
And you know something else was goofy? Was that Nero waited until they had turned back to him before he started yelling, and like, crazily. And he was like, you know, he was freaking incomprehensible most of the time, and for some reason he waited until they turned back.
Also, the selective gravity well of the black hole, where it has to, like, you, like, focuses its attention on something and then starts sucking it in?
Yeah.
What do? Grab the black hole's attention?
And, like, you know, and then, of course, there's the fact that they escape with an explosion.
Whatever, that's how explosions work now.
And they ejected, like, they said they were ejecting the warp core, and then they ejected eight little things.
You make the core as big as the entire drive section, you're gonna have extra bits. Not just one tube, it's more like a series of tubes.
Uh-oh. You know, I would really... I really wish that the Mythbusters could do that. Just test if that's actually possible.
If we make a big enough explosion, can we push this car
away from this other thing?
Just whoosh!
No, specifically like...
Oh, the Mythbusters need to go find some red matter. Okay.
Yeah, they need to find a black hole and red matter and have a giant explosion. See how big an explosion has to be gets you out of the gravity
well.
We'll
put the baby Mythbusters on finding the red matter for us, and then, you know, we'll let
baby Mythbusters. What did they ever do to deserve that?
Oh, baby Mythbusters.
Well, according to Spock, there seems to be a bunch of it about.
Just hanging out. Red matter's everywhere.
Okay, so I have a minor thing to put in here. There's actually been some advancement in the field of researching a warp drive. By a warp drive, I mean a space engine that would literally warp space, theoretically allowing a ship to travel faster than the speed of light, you know, because it would be...
Apparent velocity.
Yeah. It wouldn't actually be traveling faster than the speed of light. We would be cheating. Mm-hmm. We would be, you know, rules lawyering physics.
Reducing the distances.
Yeah.
Well, I'm excited about that.
It's interesting. It's really cool. They're actually, they've, you know, this design was first... it's basically what it is it's an oval shaped ship inside a big ring, and the ring is what warps space. And this design was first suggested back in 1994, and it only had the teensy problem of creating more energy than we could ever conceivably create.
Now we fixed it.
Well, we haven't fixed it, but we've come up with some new ways to do it.
Are the rings what? Like, are they like stress? What are they like? What's the ring made out of?
I assume this is magic science.
Is it some sort of impeller ring with stress gravity bands?
Like, a miracle occurs in that ring, okay?
Because this sounds exactly like the propulsion system of the book series I've been reading.
Well, I would not be surprised if David Weber did some research and used that as a basis.
Incidentally, his books, I think, started around 1995 or 6.
Probably.
So, you know.
But anyway, this is actually, the part that's interesting is that the scientists at NASA are actually working on a scaled down model of this design to see if they can actually do it at a very, very small scale, to see if it can conceivably work.
Well, I would hope they would start small scale.
All right, so we're going to make a whole ship and see what happens, crossing our fingers.
I'm going to see if I can find, there was this one really hilarious line that someone mentioned about the space-time continuum being perturbed. Oh, here we go. We're trying to see if we can generate a very tiny instance of this in a tabletop experiment, trying to perturb space-time by one part in 10 million.
Oop-a.
And, of course, now we have to worry about space-time being perturbed.
Well, admittedly, I'm a little bit worried about that. I mean, we know that space-time can be warped, but I don't know what happens when we try to forcibly warp it.
Space-time will be jealous, and will come and lay the smackdown on us. We're trying to put the moves on it.
All right, well, speaking of smackdown, when Lily and I were watching the commentary, we found out why, according to the director, because I think Abrams is one of the guys on the commentary, the black hole sometimes destroys you and sometimes sends you back in time. And their explanation... was that if you have a working ship while you go into the black hole, it's like navigating a whirlpool. But if your ship is broken, you're going to sink.
It's real broke. Oh, that's why they shot Nero's ship.
Yeah.
To break it. Uh-huh. They knew what was
to
up.
To save whoever was on the other side of that time hole.
I like the idea of Nero's ship showing up in Enterprise.
Yeah.
What's up?
Oh my god. They would get rolled.
How's it going, Archer?
I mean, like, I would even be fine with that explanation if they had mentioned it and if they weren't so juvenile about it. Mm-hmm. I mean, come on, this is supposed to be Kirk, you know, coming to the point where he can actually pilot a ship, and that's his final decision? That's the one we're left with?
Maybe like Spock pointing out that if the ship isn't destroyed, it will just go back and cause more trouble back down the time stream.
In fact, that actually could have been a really interesting point, is at the end of it, like, maybe Kirk is like, get us out of here, and then Spock's like, Captain, we have to go back, because if we don't, it'll just show up 25 years in the past.
Oh my god, we won't be around to stop it.
Or, you know, 25 years is just the time I pulled out of my butt.
Yeah.
Any amount of time.
They could kill our ancestors and blow up other planets we like.
Mm-hmm.
And it actually could have worked. They actually could have made that an asset instead of a weakness.
Yep.
But instead, not so much.
I just like the idea of the black hole flipped a coin when someone would go through. It's like, I might send you back in time, I might just blow you up.
Who knows?
Maybe Vulcan somewhere back in time. It's just kind of hanging out.
Mm-hmm.
This Vulcan shows up and there's just another Vulcan and back in time. It's really okay.
I was very confused at how few spaceships there were around Vulcan. Like, I get that the fleet is somewhere else, but what about just civilian spaceships?
Those don't exist.
I thought it was really funny that, like, in a crisis, the elders and all the most important
hide in a cave
where no one can reach them.
You would think you would hide in a bunker with, like, emergency transporters to, like, get you out if there was a problem that the bunker wouldn't protect you from.
Or just somewhere that doesn't have giant statues that fall over.
I never liked those guys on the council anyway.
I mean, like, I can kind of understand them wanting to be in a place where they are secure, but, you know, we have contingencies for protecting our president or other world leaders. Like, they go to places where you can contact them, but, you know, through codes and through specific lines of communication, they don't just go hide.
Also, you would think that,
Obama just climbs into his attic whenever there's a problem.
Way!
He's just, you know, or like that dome in the Congress building. You know what that's for.
Secret clubhouse.
Anyway, go ahead.
I was always, like, kind of assumed that, like, really heavily, heavily populated planets and really important planets, like Vulcan and Earth, would have, like, because Earth has a defense grid. They say it.
Yep. We never see it.
We never see
it,
but apparently it has one. Where it didn't do anything, I guess. But you would think Vulcan would have something like that, because Vulcan's been around longer, and they must understand that at some point their fleet won't be around. They won't have mobile assets available to defend this planet that can't move.
Well, we don't know that there wasn't people there, because when we first arrive at Vulcan and there's all the explodey ships, we don't know, like she says, we're not hearing transmissions of any kind, so we know that any Vulcan ships were exploding.
Well, I'm not talking about, I'm talking about, like, hardpoint defenses, like, on, like, Delta Vega, because it's a moon where you could just load it up with guns and just hang it out there and just be like, okay, ships show up that want to murder Vulcan, this moon will shoot at them.
Well, maybe it's
also we know that, like, the what's it called, the Narada was already mining Vulcan when they sent out their distress signal, because the drill was causing the seismic activity that they reported. So somehow the Narada approached Vulcan without being seen.
Oh yes, the patented Reaper approach, I believe. We lost contact with the moon.
Oh yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Someone want to get on a telescope and take a look at
someone
it?
Someone want to take a look at the moon, see if the moon's okay. We're not hearing from them anymore.
Yeah. So somehow the Narada, maybe the Narada is stealthy. Maybe in the future mining ships have cloaking devices.
Ooh, super stealthy mining.
I don't know.
Ooh, maybe the Borg gave. That's terrifying.
Bunch
of cloaked Borg cubes show up. Oh my god.
Why would they even care?
Jesus.
I don't know. So that whole thing is goofy. I mean, I'm assuming the reason why we never saw the Earth defense grid, I think the justification is supposed to be because he was like, give me the Earth defense grid. I'm putting a thing in your mouth.
Starfleet refuses to change their codes.
Yeah, and Starfleet just didn't change
their
codes.
It's the good sportsmanship laws.
I mean, I guess it's possible Starfleet didn't know that Pike had been captured because, like, their communications were cut off, and because Kirk was all, like, gung-ho, they weren't able to actually go warn the fleet.
I think it's funny that they're able to send in, like, probes that tell you what their heart rate is, but they can't, you know, hide a thing that will tell you what they're saying.
I wonder what the drill does to block communications, like, on the other side of the planet. Because, like, planets are big and thick.
It's a white noise generator.
I also like the fact that, you know, you put the blocker thingy, not, like, in your ship anywhere, but on the drill.
Also, did you know there were dudes, like, living in the drill? Like, what were they doing there? What was their job? Hey. Were they, like, the black-helmeted dudes on the Death Star that pulled the lever that shot the laser?
Look, maybe those were, like, maintenance dudes.
Just hanging out in the drill.
I would hope that there'd be people down at the blocking station, because otherwise people are just like, meh.
I would hate to live next to the murder laser. That thing looks dangerous.
Someone has to do it.
I wouldn't want to be the murder laser operator.
Honestly, it might be a better setup. than the main part of the ship, because it's flooded.
That's true. That whole ship is not OSHA compliant.
I certainly wouldn't want to work on that ship.
Speak to Nero about his safety conditions.
Like, we really don't know how well, you know, the living situation was down on the bit. I mean, that might have been nice.
Sweet waterbed. Maybe that's what all that
was. So here's something that also bothered me a little bit, is why were Kirk and Spock's phasers set to kill when they beamed onto the Narada? We see that stun works just fine.
Murder.
I mean, did they just want to kill themselves, a bunch of Vulcans?
I mean, a bunch of Romulans?
Were they just, like, itching to kill some people? That kind of leaves a bad taste in my mouth.
I can understand Spock doing it. I don't know. It's to action-y it up, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, nerds don't think it's cool when you're not killing people.
I think it's cool when you're not killing people.
I'm a nerd.
Maybe they saved them from black hole.
I guess.
Yeah, we saved you from terrible black hole time travel murder.
I mean, stun guns are difficult things in any setting, because either we're going to be dealing with it being way too powerful, or not using it during times it just makes sense, because we're not monsters.
Also, maybe JJ or someone on the thing has noticed all the flack that, like, Voyager and Enterprise get for how ineffectual phasers appear to be. And they want to be like, phasers are a problem. None of our characters ever get shot, because if they get shot, they're dead.
Yeah, so, like, I mean, I prefer the phasers killing things to phasers having absolutely no effect, but...
Yeah, maybe that's why they did it. And also, maybe just give the single stun more importance. Maybe. I don't know.
I really like the idea of phasers being a multi-setting device.
Yeah.
Like, that's always been my favorite thing. I think DS9 was the only one that really went into that at all, where it's like, you know, it has a kill setting. I think it also has, you know, it just destroy any matter in front of it. But, like, it has all these different settings, and you don't know if you shoot something, if it's going to go down, or if you're going to have to, like, amp it up, and, like, you want to stun them, but...
Better safe than sorry.
Well, yeah. I mean, so here's the way I always assumed it to work. The phaser has a number of settings, and we know that. Deep Space Nine codified it as being 16 settings, but we know that it has a bunch, even before that. And we know they have a thing called maximum stun. Now, I assume that maximum stun is their best guess for the highest they can set the phaser and have it still not kill your average humanoid.
Yeah.
And I assume that's just their best guess. And everything after that is kill, because it's assumed to be such a high setting that it will just, you know, it will kill them. And it at that point, it stops being like an electroshock weapon and becomes just an actual laser. It's sort of the way I always assumed it worked. I do like the idea of it having it be like a dial instead of just having two settings.
There seem to be toggles.
I mean, we know that in TNG there are toggles, because, like, you know, when that super, like, drugged out super soldier gets on the ship, they shoot him with, like, just really low level, like, annoying phaser setting, and he's like, "Why are you doing that?"
And then
they turn it all the way up, and he's like, "Okay, now it's serious."
Yeah.
I feel like it really sets the tone for Starfleet and the Federation if it has multiple settings. Like, it explains as to why they're different from other warring species, where, like, they're actually annoyed by their guns, because it's just like, oh, there's so many settings, and it's so complicated.
It feels like, it sounds like a good idea in theory, but then once you get out into the field and fiddling with the dial, it'd be like, did I put it on the right setting? I gotta murder, like, 30 Jem'Hadar on this thing. Do I gotta
beam? Like, when you turn on your car and someone set it up to, like, you know, maximum, like,
but
on all the dials.
I like the idea of the Federation Starfleet's, like, guns, being set up by guys who are like, oh, we don't really want to kill people.
We will give you so many settings that don't kill people. Look at all these settings.
Yeah, like, you have options. We are trying to be diplomatic here. We don't want to give you a thing that just burns people to ashes.
I also like that Star Trek VI introduced the concept that if you stun someone too much, it can kill them.
Yeah, that's good.
Like, I thought that was good.
Another dose of the medical phaser.
They also kind of had that in... They also had that in, as much as I hate to bring this episode up, the one where Geordi got captured by Paklids. The Paklids keep shooting
him
with
things.
The Paklids keep shooting him with the stun setting. And they're like, you know, that's gonna kill him eventually.
Except their phasers to kick ass.
Yeah, of course, that's also one of the points where the phaser, like, lifts you into the air and knocks you back.
Man, those are my favorite phasers.
There's set phasers to ass kick.
Wow.
But okay, are we done? Do we have anything more to say about the 2009
movie?
I'm
out of things. It was a good movie.
Yeah.
Great fun. Recommend it to anyone who hasn't seen it yet.
Yeah, I hope they. If they're still listening and they haven't seen it yet.
If you listen to this podcast, you've probably seen it.
Yeah, so again, this episode is being recorded on Tuesday night. So if you send emails after that, we will read them next week when Bob and I will be back for serious business. So with that in mind, this is All Things Trek signing off.